Welcome to The Indigenous Approach, a podcast where we examine the role of the nation's premier partnership force across the competition continuum, from cooperation to conflict and everything in between. In this episode, Colonel Ed Crute, the 1st Special Forces Command Chief of Staff, speaks with Christian Brose, author of The Kill Chain, Defending America in the Future of High-Tech Warfare.
Greetings. My name is Colonel Ed Crute. I'm the Chief of Staff at 1st Special Forces Command. And on behalf of our Commanding General, Major General Brennan, I'd like to welcome you to our inaugural podcast. The purpose of this first podcast is to try and gain a shared understanding across our formation of our third line of effort, innovation. Innovation is different from modernization. And this was very deliberately chosen by our Commanding General. But our formation is having trouble understanding the difference between modernization and innovation. Because of that, we've decided to do an innovation symposium in order to set conditions for that successful symposium. We have asked author Chris Brose, who has just released a book in April titled The Kill Chain, to assist us in gain that shared understanding. And you may recognize Chris from his work as Senator McCain's senior policy advisor for many years. Chris, welcome.
No, thanks, Ed. It's great to be with you and appreciate it.
Yeah, no, we're honored to have you. We appreciate your help and your time. So we'll get right to it. And the first question that we want to ask you is, what did you learn in your time with Senator McCain that serves as a warning to us in uniform on what the future of conflict might look like and what drove you to write the book, The Kill Chain?
Yeah, it is a great question. And I think I asked myself every single day that I was writing the book, you know, why on earth did I decide to write this book? But I think ultimately the answer can really be simplified down to in the time that I spent in the Senate, nearly decade that I spent on the Senate Armed Services Committee and working closely with Senator McCain and having not served in the military, but having worked very closely in the oversight of it, working very closely with members of the military, kind of the defense program more broadly. The bottom line was I became increasingly concerned that we were not positioned to have the kind of military advantage in the future that we have come to take for granted over many decades, and that the ultimate effect of that would be the continued erosion of not just our military technological advantage, but the erosion of our ability to deter aggression and conflict, specifically as we look at great power competitors, near peer or peer competitors in the case primarily of China, but also of Russia. And at the sort of outer edge of that, you know, to be even more blunt about it, my concern was that we could lose a future war, not in the distant future, but now. And, you know, the sort of reasons that I sort of began to come to that conclusion, you know, I really sort of trace back in the book to kind of 2014, where I think we in the defense world had sort of a, you know, collective mugging by reality that occurred when Russian forces went into Ukraine. And, you know, I think what we saw there was a very different approach to warfare than the one that we had been waging, an ability to move very rapidly to field, kind of sensor systems, unmanned systems, and rapidly close the kill chain from collection of information to target identification to effects employment very, very quickly. And, you know, the trips that I remember taking with Senator McCain to Ukraine, the stories that we, you know, were told, this was just a very different type of Russian military than I think the ones that we had been paying attention to. And really a very different kind of force than the one that we had spent, really, I would argue, 30 years sort of preparing for. And then really specifically in the aftermath of 9/11, actually engaged in combat operations against. This was a high-tech adversary, relied on unmanned systems, very rapid command and control, the ability to move sensor to shooter incredibly quickly, to employ all kinds of incredibly lethal effects from electronic warfare all the way to precision guided rocket artillery, and just very, very lethally identify Ukrainian targets and make quick work of them. And, you know, I think that sort of led in the congressional side to a focus on really, I think, what the fullest manifestation of that problem looks like, which really is China. And the fact, I think, that, you know, this was not like a hurricane or a natural disaster that sort of hit us one day. In the case of the Chinese competitor, this is an adversary or a competitor that's been working very deliberately for a very long period of time to build military capabilities that aren't designed to replicate how we fight. It's designed to call into question all of the assumptions on which we have built our force and plan to use it in combat. And the types of problems that they would be presenting to the joint force as it attempted to move into an environment to respond to aggression, to kind of fight along that continuum as you described, to me increasingly looked like a problem that with the force that we had and the ways that we had intended traditionally to employ that force, we were not going to be able to achieve the objectives that the nation has set out and do the kinds of things from a policy perspective that we want to be able to do. So to be rather pointed about it, my concern was that we were falling behind. We had an adversary that was intently focused on disrupting us, and that they had been made much more progress than I think many people inside the Department of Defense, certainly many people inside the Congress, and absolutely the American public writ large had really realized. So, the fine point on it was, I wanted to write a book that brought what I consider to be, the central problem facing America's national defense a little bit more into the public light, that a general audience could engage with, that would be intelligible and understandable to them, so that they really understood the problem that, that I and I think a lot of others believe that our national defense is facing as we look to a future that is going to be very different than the past we've experienced.
No, that's great. Thank you, Chris. And you'd have to look pretty hard right now to find your book on one of the commanding generals' reading lists right now, because it is a stark wake-up call for all of us. What I'd like to do next is ask you about what we might be facing as a force. And to do that, I'd like to lay out what our command, we see our command doing. And so, as mentioned and defined by SOCOM, the competition continuum. And so our force, as I said, is about 24,000. It's all the special forces, psychological operations, and soft civil affairs on the Army side. And so we are interpreting the direction of the national security strategy and national defense strategy in the early parts of this. On the cooperation side, we're in about 80 countries at any one time. And so we are definitely reassuring partners and allies in cooperation. But we also find ourselves in those 80 countries, not just in the capitals, where most of our interagency and whatnot find themselves, but this command finds itself in the irregular warfare areas, in the frontiers, on the borders, in the places like Syria, et cetera. And we are running up against our competitors. And so in that competition space, we also believe that we are strategic sensors for the nation and for our GM partners. And in not only the physical space or what we can find out through our partners, but also in the cognitive and the information and the virtual spaces. And so we do think that we are the first to see the 4+1. So when I read your book and I understood the title, The Kill Chain, I really felt like we were probably the front side of that for our nation in a lot of ways. So if you could describe for the listening audience what the title Kill Chain means, and then what you think about how I just described our RSOF role in cooperation and competition.
Yeah. The reason I really sort of came to embrace the idea of the kill chain is kind of an organizing concept for the book. And look, the term's been around for a long time. I didn't invent it. There's a lot about my book, which, as I went through the process of sort of researching and writing it, what I found myself just kind of shocked by is how many of the things that I think and thought are things that, far smarter, more experienced people have been saying for a hell of a lot longer than I have. The surprising thing is just the extent to which we have consistently failed or come up short or just been unable or unwilling to make the kinds of changes that a lot of people have been saying have been necessary for a long period of time. So with respect to that and the kill chain, the way I tend to sort of, you know, my frustrations with our defense establishment, by which I mean not just the Department of Defense, but, you know, the Congress and its role in this, you know, sort of industry, traditional and otherwise, and its role in this. I mean, it really is sort of an ecosystem. And my frustration was that we all too often are focused on the wrong things. And we're measuring the wrong things in terms of the performance metrics that really matter to determine how we match up against competitors. And we tend to think in terms of inputs. We get very focused on platforms, per unit costs and the individual capabilities and performance parameters and how many of them are going to be built in what year and what state. And you know, ultimately all of those, in my opinion, are just tools and inputs. But the real thing that we need to be focused on, the real thing that generates military advantage, is this process of the kill chain, as the military has talked about it for some time. In an offensive sense, that means you know, how you close the kill chain. In a defensive sense, it means how do I break the kill chains of my adversaries. And really that's, you know, for me, I sort of try, because I'm trying to write for more of a general audience. You know, there are very specific, you know, kind of more technical ways that you can begin to break this down into the find, fix, target, track. The ways that I think about it are more overarching in the sense of it is understanding, it is decision making, and it is action. And too often we focus on the virtue of military power only in the sense of acting. You know, it's the weapons that we're going to employ, it's the platforms that are going to employ them. But really military advantage is going to be generated through the process of understanding what's happening in the environment, both left of conflict and during conflict. In the event of conflict, identifying targets and objects of interest, enabling human beings to make decisions about them, and then taking actions in an incredibly fast way. So ultimately, this is a cognitive competition. And the cognitive competition reverts around how quickly, at what scale, and how effectively can I move through that process of understanding what's happening, making decisions, and taking actions. And the thing, I mean, to your question, that I really try to center on in the book is that this is fundamentally a human-centric problem. Technology will be helpful to us in providing us tools, providing us kind of increasingly capable technologies and capabilities to improve our understanding of the environment, kind of enable and facilitate and accelerate human decision-making, and ultimately enable sort of human action at larger scales, at greater ranges. But ultimately, this is about the human being that has to be kind of on that loop of that kill chain. And, you know, I think with respect to, you know, the mission, as you described it from the SOF perspective, you know, I 100% agree that SOF is going to be, very relevant at the front end of that process, because you are going to be, you know, at that contact layer, you're going to be at that blunt layer, you're going to be, in many cases, the sources of early indications and warning. You're going to be making the human judgments that machines can't make, in the sense of sort of deriving intent from action, trying to contextualize information, trying to determine what the intent of an adversary is by things that they're doing, systems that they're moving, things that are going to be very difficult for, you know, sensors and machines left to their own devices to really understand and contextualize. We are going to rely on human beings to make sense of that information. And in many cases, in most cases, those are going to be human beings who are closest to the point of friction and closest to where those events are happening, and have the most granular understanding in the environments and with the partners, you know, where those events are occurring. But what I would immediately say is that as we think about the continuum, as you've described it, to me, it really is going to be a continuum. And as I've reflected on, you know, what I've written in the book in the aftermath of publishing it, you know, I tend to think that just as the kill chain is a continuum that we are going to have to sort of move through and cycle through very quickly, a lot of the ways that we sort of arbitrarily try to break up battle space and understanding of the operational environment, I think, are just increasingly going to fall by the wayside. you know, in a world where, you know, SOF operators are relying on space assets to generate understanding of the environment and then call in effects, you know, electronic warfare or kinetic or otherwise, you know, from other services, you know, tell me what's tactical and what's operational and what's strategic. You know, tell me what's phase one and what's phase two, three, and four. You know, tell me what's intel and what's ops, what's J2 and what's J3. I think these sort of structures that we put around our understanding of warfare and, you know, operational environments are just going to fall by the wayside based on how technology is forcing us to think about these problems differently and based on how our adversaries are forcing us to think differently about the types of problems that we're going to have to be able to solve operationally and the types of predicaments that they're actively seeking to put us in. And I think first and foremost, central to that are going to be the human beings who are part of our special forces and special operations forces, who are going to be, highly cognitively capable, experienced operators who are going to be operating inside of those envelopes and inside of those environments to really be the humans on those loops of commanding and controlling those kill chains, from the tactical level all the way up to the operational and strategic level. Because in many instances, we're not going to have the ability to get, you know, all of that information back to human beings sitting in, you know, very large division or operational or air operations centers, headquarters. It's going to be the human being out at the forward edge in the tactical environment that's going to be, really making decisions and taking actions and generating insights that are going to have, you know, not just tactical and operational significance, but strategic significance.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. Now, what I'd like to do is use that middle part of this continuum. So we're in competition right now. We haven't gotten too close to conflict yet. And in your book, you also refer and remind us that we've got phenomenal people. Our military Yep. is full of America's best. But right now, within SOF, some of us are stuck. And it's just because we can't understand. We can't picture what this future threat looks like to the degree that it really is. And so as we are doing our best to keep us short of conflict and we start getting closer and closer to conflict, what does that look like? What is the teeth that you describe in the book in terms of what China is trying to build? Because it's important for our folks to be able to understand that so they know what to look for. So yeah. That maybe that Chinese presence at that port today is a road and belt port in 5 years, and it just might be a DS-21-26 carrier killer location in 2035 or 2040. So in order for us to be successful, we have to understand and be able to visualize what that threat looks like. Could you help our audience with that?
And it goes right back to that first question of why did I write the book? And, it is the belief that threat has become incredibly, incredibly capable and sophisticated in ways that I think many, even inside the defense establishment, don't fully realize and appreciate. And I think, we tend to think, and I hear a lot of talk about, what is this threat going to look like in 2048, 2030? I think this is a pretty formidable threat right now, to the extent that I would worry about how an actual conflict would go right now. If God forbid it came to it. And ultimately that's because, really for the better part of three decades, the Chinese Communist Party has been focusing on building a military, innovating and fielding a military that is not designed to, fight the same ways as the U.S. military. I mean, it's fundamentally designed to call into question the assumptions on which the U.S. military has been built and the ways that we would operate that force in conflict. And if you go all the way back to really the end of the first Gulf War, which is when the Chinese Communist Party sort of began the journey that it's been on ever since, they started from the supposition that they did not want what happened to Iraq to happen to them. So they wanted to call into question how America projects military power. And they went about that very deliberately. They started with What are the core advantages that America brings militarily? It has traditionally been our ability to fight from sanctuary, you know, to build up forces and forward operating bases. It's the ability to control the timing and the tempo of military operations so that even if an adversary began conflict with an act of aggression, we would be able to mass forces and then essentially really start the war at a time of our choosing and really dictate and control the tempo and timing of that engagement. And then it is the, it has been the ability to fight from a position of military technological superiority to any adversary that we've been fighting. And I think that in many ways, you know, people talk about 9/11 changing everything. I think in many respects, it actually just forced us to double down on those assumptions because they all held true in the wars that we've been fighting since 2001. But when you look at what the Chinese have done, they have begun fielding capabilities that call into question all of those assumptions that we've made. So they have focused on the warfighting infrastructure that America would project power from in the Indo-Pacific in the event of a conflict, on Guam, in Japan, and other forward operating locations. Those are fixed installations, and they have sought to overwhelm them with very large quantities of precision weapons. From long range, intermediate range, short range, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and increasingly hypersonic weapons. The idea being if you can overwhelm a target with so many weapons that it's incapable of defending itself, you'll be able to saturate it at a relatively low cost. As they've looked at then not just land bases, but sea bases, the ability to project power from aircraft carriers, from large deck amphibs. They fielded integrated sensor networks to find those ships as they've moved or as they would move, you know, closer to the Chinese mainland in the event of a conflict to project military power. So fielding long-range reconnaissance satellites, over-the-horizon radars, other sophisticated sensor systems to find those assets at sea, and then similarly to try to overwhelm them with very large quantities of relatively low cost, very precise weapons in the form of, yes, the DF-21, DF-26 anti-ship ballistic missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles, again, increasingly hypersonic weapons, and just more and more sophisticated, very massed effects to overwhelm the abilities of those assets to defend themselves. As they've looked at how we would project power from the air, the Chinese have built up very dense and very sophisticated integrated air defense complexes to push U.S. strike aircraft farther and farther away from the targets that they would ultimately have to service. And whether those assets or those air assets are coming off of land bases or off of sea bases, forcing them to have to fight at a range that outstrips their ability to get to the target such that they're relying on aerial refueling capabilities that are themselves inherently defenseless because they have no organic self-defense capability. And those now become very vulnerable single points of failure that the adversary can try to take away from us and thus render, you know, the very large quantities of short-range tactical aircraft, short-range strike aircraft that we have, effectively useless in a conflict. Then building on top of that, you know, to what Chinese doctrine refers to as systems destruction warfare, the ability to break our kill chains in terms of how we collect information, collect and refine intelligence, move information around the battlefield, command and control forces, use space for all of that enabling capability, assuming that it, you know, would be a sanctuary for us. Here too, you know, the Chinese are fielding directed energy weapons, anti-satellite, direct ascent anti-satellite weapons, high energy, high powered jamming capabilities with the intent of taking away all of that sort of connective tissue and enabling capability that we have come to take for granted would always be there in the event of a conflict to enable the collection and movement and use of information by deployed forces. And then ultimately sort of thinking about, you know, how we would logistically sustain what could be a very long engagement. Here too, all of that warfighting capability that we bring to bear as far as sea lift and airlift, all of which has been built without organic self-defense capability, because the assumption we've always made is that they would not be under attack. All of that is now being overturned by the types of capabilities that the Chinese are building to find and target and ultimately take off the battlefield. The critical means by which we would resupply and sort of field new capabilities into that fight. And oh, by the way, that would start, you know, well to the left, of D-Day, because all of that infrastructure in the United States would be surveilled and ultimately targeted and attacked through cyber means, through electronic attack and other types of non-kinetic capabilities that would just grind the deployment and sort of mobilization of the force to a halt. So when you add this all up, you know, it is a very sophisticated and rapidly improving military capability on the part of the Chinese that, again, is not built to fight the way we fight. It is built to prevent us from fighting the way we have traditionally planned to fight, to find all of those, you know, very expensive, very exquisite, very manpower intensive military platforms that we rely upon to fight, and holding those systems at risk, or just defeating them by rendering them incapable of even getting onto the objective or into a position to be operationally relevant. That's how they've been attacking this problem. You know, when we talk about anti-access and area denial, that's what it ultimately means. And I think what it ultimately means for the joint force is the way we have been planning to fight and what we have been planning to fight with is not going to be available to us in the future to the degree that we have assumed. And again, you know, I think the conclusion that many have drawn, not just myself, as they've looked at this problem, as they've wargamed it, as they've done independent panels and reviews, of where we stand and how we match up, is that increasingly it's looking pretty grim for us, and that changing how we fight and what we fight with is not something that we should do because it would be nice. It is now existential, because if we don't change, we will fail to be able to deter conflict at the conventional level, and that if, God forbid, we ended up in conflict, we may very well lose the next war that the force was asked to fight.
All right. No, that's great. Thank you, Chris. As I mentioned in the beginning, Major General Brennan deliberately chose the word innovation for our third line of effort. And I think what you've helped, and when you look at that, there are many that have described the difference to me as modernization is making what you already have better, but innovation is understanding what that future fight looks like, and then what your unique role is in that fight as an organization, and then what gaps do you have to try and be able to contribute in that fight. And so what you've just laid out for us is outstanding, and exactly what as an organization we'd have to commit to a better understanding every day, so we can be able to progress in the way that we need to. I think for our final question today, what I'd like to focus on is one of your chapters that was titled The Tale of Two Cities. And I think that's a really important chapter as well. And to build a little context, so there's multiple organizations here that have already hired on military organizations that have hired on CTOs or chief technical officers for their organizations. And when we go to do our innovation symposium next week, the very first panel with Major General Brennan is Josh Edwards from Amazon and Snehal Antani, who we were able to hire away from Silicon Valley. Josh actually happens to also be in the Naval Reserves. But I think the fact that we have them as some of our first speakers is due directly to the problem that you illuminate and highlight, and the caution that you give us in the chapter Tale of Two Cities. So I'd ask if you could you share with our audience what that means and what that caution is?
Yeah, and I think just teeing back to the comments you just made about the difference between modernization and innovation, I think really cuts to the heart of it. The concern that I have and have had for a while as I've looked at, you know, how we build and field military capability is that at best we are modernizing. We are thinking about how to incrementally improve the things that we have had, in many cases, have relied upon for decades to deliver us military advantage. when really the right question that we need to be asking is not, you know, how do I generate requirements for a more modern version of the thing that I've always had, but how do I actually solve the operational problems that I'm being presented with differently, cheaper, faster, better, at larger scale, so that I can flip that advantage or I can flip the problems back and impose costs on the adversary in a way that the adversary has been imposing costs on us. So, you know, to some extent, what I get into in the chapter that you referenced is, I think another key piece of this challenge is the extent to which technology that is being developed in the commercial world, particularly the technologies that senior Department of Defense leaders and members of Congress are talking about as central to military advantage in the future. So artificial intelligence and machine learning, autonomous systems, distributed systems, advanced networking. These types of technologies have been progressed at a pace that has just completely outstripped what the Department of Defense has access to in its traditional industrial base. And, you know, this has not been something that happened by accident. It's something that happened through a process of incentives that have been created over a very long time, that have generated an industrial base, a military or defense industrial base that is far smaller, far more consolidated, and far less innovative than it once was, and certainly than I think what we're seeing in a lot of these commercial technology companies. I think part of the issue gets to the fact that we've been so hubristic about the position of dominance that we've had in the world militarily, that we've thought that the problem is actually how do we just make better the things that we've had, because those things have delivered us military advantage for decades. And we haven't been able to think beyond that. Whereas I think in the commercial world, what is being focused on are how do we consistently and constantly disrupt the business models and the products that are being fielded to gain competitive advantage? A Netflix is able to disrupt a Blockbuster Video, and then a Netflix is able to disrupt itself. What are the processes that we're putting in place in the defense establishment to ensure that we are going to be able to create requirements for things that we don't know yet that we need, that we're going to create, you know, kind of the conditions for us to be surprised. And that's something that I think we do a very poor job of. And, you know, I think the problem as it's kind of metastasized in recent years has sort of put the Defense Department, I would argue, you know, in some cases, 10 to 15 years behind where state of the art is in terms of modern commercial technology with regards to AI, ML, autonomy, and the types of technologies that the department, I think, now recognizes it needs. And, you know, just, you know, by way of an example, which I reference in the book, you know, when we talk about the, you know, onboard computer processing that is available to put onto deployed systems, military platforms or commercial vehicles, in the Defense Department, you know, we talk about the F-35 is the flying supercomputer. And as it compares to any other weapon system in the inventory, it is that. I mean, it is light years ahead in terms of its ability to collect and process information onboard that system. But when you actually look at the computer processor that is doing that operation, and you compare it to what are modern state-of-the-art graphics processing units and computer processing units and AI accelerators that are being fielded onboard commercial cars and trucks, Teslas, other self-driving vehicles, those computing cores are hundreds of times more capable, as in they can perform hundreds of times more operations per second than the computer that is onboard the F-35. And when you actually really get to the meat and potatoes of what artificial intelligence and autonomy really are, it's the scale of computing and the amount of data that you can process. So if I have more computer processing on board the Tesla in the parking lot at my office than I do on board the most sophisticated weapon system in the DoD inventory, you know, that is just going to create a significant void between what is possible when it comes to the real applications of these technologies for warfighting as compared to their applications in the commercial environment. And the thing that has really just come to frustrate me as I've looked at this is these technologies aren't science fiction. You know, they are accessed and accessible to our men and women in uniform every day in their commercial lives, where they rely upon, you know, kind of increasingly sophisticated networks of very intelligent and increasingly autonomous sensor systems and other machines to enable the very same understanding, decision-making, and action that the military has to engage in through, you know, through the standpoint of the kill chain. You know, that's what these technologies are enabling me to do in my daily life, is to have better understanding of my environment, better understanding of my house or my operations or the information that I have at my disposal, to help me make better and faster decisions that save me time and improve the quality of my life, and ultimately take actions that are going to advantage me. These technologies are, in many cases, solved problems in the commercial world. They just haven't been applied to military problems. And part of that comes down to the fact that many of the companies that are building them aren't interested in doing work for the US military, plain and simple. You know, there are many that are, there are many that are seeking to do that. And in my day job, I work at one of them. It's not because people in technology aren't interested in military problems. I mean, I would argue that the vast majority of engineers out there are very eager to help solve these problems. They just need to have the incentives to be in a position to do so. But the fundamental problem we have right now that I try to address in that chapter of The Tale of Two Cities is that, you know, the defense establishment as it exists and the commercial technology world, the advanced technologies that are being built and fielded by, you know, in many cases, American companies, there's just a significant void between what is state of the art in the military right now and what is state of art being fielded by, you know, commercial software companies, commercial AI and autonomy companies. And if we don't close that gap and figure out how to overcome that void and get the best technologies that are available in this country and being developed by companies in this country to be fielded and directed to solving military problems that in many cases, in most cases, are going to be very different kinds of problems than the way the commercial technologies are going to have to work. You know, these technologies are going to have to work for environments and under sort of degrees of threat and insecurity that are fundamentally different than the commercial world. But the technologies themselves can enable the U.S. military to move into the future in a way that is not something that we need to be sort of waiting for in 2030 or 2040. I mean, this is doable right now. And that to me has become, you know, one of my biggest sources of frustration, certainly as I've written the book in the time that I've been out of government, is just the degree to which we can access this technology now and help solve the types of problems that, you know, you and the commanding general and the entire team are trying to get after. This is not something that you have to wait a very long time for. And if we enable that sort of traditional process to work through its traditional ways of trying to predict exactly the specific requirements that I'm going to need, you know, to be relevant in 2025 and 2030, you know, that's not the way this technology is going to get fielded and employed and directed to military advantage. Not in the way that we've traditionally tried to do it. We've got to do this in a different way. And yeah, to your point about chief technology officers, the value of those types of people in those types of positions is that they can actually help an organization understand what really is state of the art and really understand at the level of technical detail how these technologies are going to be employable to solve the types of problems that, you know, you and your command are going to have to be able to solve and the types of places and environments where you're going to have to solve them. So that type of marriage between the remarkable amount of military expertise that you have in the command and then, you know, in the broader Special Operations Command environment, together with, you know, the types of CTO technology or CTO type folks and sort of what they bring to bear in terms of their understanding of the technology and the marriage that can be brought between, you know, kind of warfighting expertise and technological expertise, I think is ultimately how we're going to figure out, you know, what the right solutions are and help us move into the future faster.
No, that's great. Thank you. And we need help. And there are a lot of people out there that that are ready to provide that help. We just have to connect the dots. And, you know, I can't thank you enough for your time with us. I'm convinced that you're helping us take a step in the right direction. What I'd like to do, I'll kick it back to you for your closing comments. But one thing that's really important to also highlight from your book, was you talk about how great the people are that are in the military and that are in government. That's not the problem. We have phenomenal and talented people. It's just being able to come together as the team, think creatively, and define the problem and get everybody moving in the right direction for those that are ready to help. That's gonna get us going in the right direction. So, you know, I'll kick it to you for closing comments.
Yeah. So, you know, I would close on exactly that. You know, I have been incredibly fortunate in the time that I've gotten to work in government and now in my life after government to work with people like you, the remarkable people who join our military, the civilians who are part of that team as well. This is the absolute best that America has to offer in terms of being creative problem solvers, innovators, people who want to get after the hardest problems and solve them for the good of the nation. That is 100% not the problem. You know, what frustrates me and sort of, you know, just drives me to distraction is how the system is consistently failing those people and forcing them to work harder and longer and ultimately at greater risk because they're being asked to do so with technologies or capabilities or in processes that are just suboptimal and are not state of the art. And, you know, if there's one reason I wrote the book, it's certainly not to become, you know, an incredibly wealthy best-selling author, you know, which I have decidedly not become still. It is because I very much want to, in some way, try to make that task easier for people like you, folks in the command, who are trying to solve these problems every day, who are inside the arena. If there's something that I can do or some way in which my book contributed to giving those folks a bit of a tailwind so that they have, you know, more ability to do the right things, get the kinds of capabilities they need, and then think totally differently about how they're going to employ them for the good of the nation, that's a win in my opinion. So it's a tremendous opportunity for me to have the time to spend with you. Really looking forward to future engagements with you and the command and your team. And really just, all I would end on is saying thank you to you and the work that you're trying to do and sort of highlighting these issues and really kind of giving them the attention that they deserve, which I think, you know, most people really know. I mean, I've been, you know, just pleasantly surprised by, like, these are not new problems, and people inside the department, inside the military, they know what the score is. They know what they need to do differently. I just want to see a system that actually lifts these people up and enables them to be successful rather than sort of putting roadblocks and impediments and difficulty in front of them.
Oh, great. Thank you for that. And we are listening. And, you know, again, with the ultimate goal of gaining a shared understanding of where we need to move as an organization. So again, Chris, thank you. And thanks to everyone.
Thank you.
This has been the Indigenous Approach. We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Follow us on social media, and if you have suggestions for topics or guests, send us a message. Thank you for listening.